Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does an actress remake herself for roles that range from smart comedy to heart-wrenching drama, and how does she continue to grow and evolve as an artist? Marcia Gay Harden won an Oscar for her 2000 performance in Pollock, was nominated again in 2003 for her role in Mystic River, and in 2009 she earned a Tony for Best Actress in God of Carnage. She was also nominated for an Emmy for her appearances as an FBI agent in the TV series Law & Order SVU. She herself spent part of her formative years in Texas, earning a theater degree at UT Austin. Marcia, welcome to Think.
Hey, thank you. It's good to be here.
So your dad was in the Navy. You grew up all over the world.
That's right, but I had grandparents who lived in Kingsland, Texas, so we journeyed back to Texas every summer, long, long car trips, five kids in a station wagon and a dog in the back, and we grew up in the summer on LBJ Lake and water skiing with the water moccasins, which is horrifying, and then eventually I went back to the University of Texas. My dad had been stationed in Greece, so I went to my first year of college in Greece, my second in Germany, and then came here for University of Texas.
Did that feel like a culture shock, or did it feel like something you knew?
It's a huge culture shock. Europe and America anyway are so different. Yeah. And at the time, I mean, just even the sizes of the cars. And in Texas, there really aren't cars. There's trucks. So it was a definite culture shock to come back here, which there's always something wonderful that you're receiving when you come to a place. But there's also the other side of it, things are quite different and the ideologies are quite different.
How important is where a character comes from? If there's not a dialect in a role or something, how much thought do you put into where that person comes from geographically?
That's a great question. I put quite a bit into that. Most of the characters I would play would come from someplace in America. But I think where people live, different regions that people live, suggests a different mindset. Of course, today it's far less defined than it maybe was years ago because television homogenizes all experiences. So the Midwest may not seem as Midwest, let's say, as it did years ago because there's television telling us this is what life is like anywhere. But I think about where they come from. I think that might tell me a rhythm they might have. It might tell me a rhythm of walking they might have. It might tell me a religion they might have. Exposures that they would have. And so certainly that's one of the layers that I would pay attention to and try to build.
So how much is observation part of just being an actor?
It's a lot. It's a lot. I think of actors on some level as anthropologists. So I'm watching people move and talk and speak, and I'm watching you right now and seeing what you do and ingesting different things. And at some point, those nuances will crop up and I'll think, I know this character. I've seen this woman in the grocery store before. I know just how to be this woman because I've seen her. And then you watch more and you pick up another little nuance that you use. I remember I was at the museum one day in New York and I was getting ready to play a character for the movie Meet Joe Black. Mm-hmm. And the character that I was getting ready to play was very wealthy and certainly would have gone to museums and probably would have owned art herself and wore Givenchy suits and things like that. And I noticed this lady looking at a painting and she had glasses. But she was holding the glasses about an inch away from her face. Mm-hmm. So that every few seconds she would put them down and you would see her beautiful face. She wouldn't allow the glasses just sat on her face. Huh. And I thought, I want that. I want that for my character. She has glasses, but she's, I'm not judging vain, but she's vain enough that they don't stay on her face.
Yeah.
She up and down and up and down and up and down. That started to feed a lot of ideas about the character.
So do those little things, those little gestures and physical manifestations also help you feel the character, or is that a totally different process?
Well, feeling is a lot of emotional recall. Mm-hmm. And putting yourself in the character's place. It's the idea, there's a lot of different ideas with acting. One of them is transforming, that you just transform yourself to another character. But that journey, there's a textbook of ways to let that be achieved. And there's a famous idea in acting that says, if you want to feel joy, there's an actor who was trying to act something, I think it was in Russia, and so Stanislavski, and he couldn't feel joy. I don't know how to say this line. I'm not feeling joy. And they were told to go to a slide. And as he's going, sliding down the slide, say the line. Because you almost can't help but feel a kind of a joy.
That rush.
Rush of something, the stomach bubbling up when you're doing a physical movement. So that there's a marriage of physical movement. And you know yourself, when you're not depressed, you hold yourself in a certain way. And when you're depressed, you crush in a different way. Your voice goes to a different place. So when you start doing those things as the character, emotion bubbles. And I think it's our job. I mean, I think of myself as a very on-the-sleeve person. If I'm feeling it, you know it. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing hidden over here, unfortunately. But I think part of that is we have to keep these things, or anyway, I do for the way I work, have to keep things closer to the surface. It can't be a subterranean mining to get to what my feelings are and my emotions are. I have to keep them close to the surface so I can call upon them in any given, you know, acting exercise quickly.
So when you're playing any particular role, you know what's coming next. And even within the same scene in a TV show or a film, something can turn on a dime, but your character doesn't yet know that that's going to change. How do you sort of keep that from informing what's happening right this minute when you know, in 30 seconds something's going
to
happen?
That's one of the hardest things to do. That is absolutely one of the hardest things to do. Training. You know, I went to University of Texas in Austin, and I had an amazing teacher, Lee Abraham. And training teaches you sort of how not to make those choices. But I'll give you an example. I was doing a play once, The Seagull, in New York, and it was just the, you know, cream of the crop, from Meryl Streep to Philip Seymour to Kevin Kline, Natalie Portman. I mean, everybody was in this play. And I wanted to my character was Masha in The Seagull. And I wanted to, in my opening scene, kind of set the stage that the next character was going to come to his little outdoor theater. And my character was in love with Philip Seymour, who was going to be directing some play. So he wasn't with me in the scene. And I wanted to come out and kind of move the bench here. My character was being the stage manager, kind of setting it up for him. And I was stopped in the rehearsal process by someone saying, no, you can't do that, because in the next scene he's going to come in and you can't have said it like this, because he has to come in and just do A, B, or C with the bench or whatever. And I think, well, he doesn't know where the bench is.
Yeah.
He can still come in and do A, B, C, but look at the little obstacle. What a great obstacle. Masha, the girl who's in love with him, has once again taken the set and moved it how she wants it, or trying to be so helpful. So this was a little obstacle that we don't know. So you can't say to another actor, oh, no, you can't put your coat there because I have to sit down on the couch. Mm-hmm. That's a better example, because you know that what that is. You can't put your coat there in that scene. I have to come in and sit down on the couch. Guess what? I don't know you have to come in to sit down on the couch. So I put my coat there, and maybe when you come in, you have to move it. And maybe that movement informs something, and maybe you can pick it up on a line like in real life and move it while you're walking and talking, and then it looks like real life.
So is it a totally different thing to do a film that might be shot out of sequence and it might be shot over a period of months, as opposed to doing something on stage that is complete within 2 or 2.5 hours?
Well, the rehearsal process is what's so different. Mm-hmm. On stage, when we were just doing God of Carnage in New York, it was a 1.5 hour play with James Gandolfini and Hope Davis. And I don't know if you guys came up to see it, did you?
No, actually, I've been reading about it now, and I wish that I had.
It's a funny and outrageous and full of rage play. But anyway, we had a month of rehearsals. So we have a month of building and building and building and deepening character and all of that. In film anymore, you get there and you begin. You say your lines. So the work, the homework you have to do at home is much more. You have to come prepared. You have to know the history. You have to have researched a lot of this. Many times the directors don't give it to you. There's often very little rehearsal in film and television. And when there is rehearsal, it's about where you move. Mm-hmm. It's not about what you're thinking, what you're feeling. Try it this way, try it this way. Build is not about building a character. Those are much more rare opportunities, like what Melissa Leo just did. I know Melissa did some rehearsal for that, because that director allowed for that. But a lot of that stuff Melissa did on her own and brought it to the table. What about this? And she's bold as an actress. So you know, it was great what she did.
Where did you watch the Academy Awards last night?
I was sitting with my mom and her husband, Bill, out in Southlake, and we watched part of it. We didn't watch all of it.
So you don't feel like you have to. I guess you can check it out the next day in the paper or whatever.
Oh, God, no.
Honestly,
sometimes I think it's just so boring to watch. It's not boring to be there, mm-hmm. but it can sometimes just be a lot of jokes and inanity on some level. I feel great for my friends. That's what I feel great for. And I love seeing the sound awards, even though I know those are probably considered more boring by most people. But I love those behind the scene awards. Mm-hmm. Those, you know, a film has anywhere from 100 to 300 people on it. And it's an amazing experience at what everybody is doing and how deeply nuanced a sound editor's work might be. It's just wonderful to get to know about that. So I feel for these guys. I feel happy, great for them when they have their minutes.
Do I have this right that the first time you actually physically attended the Academy Awards was the year that you won?
That's right. For Pollock. Wow. That's right. I know. It was really a blessing, unusual.
Are there things about that night that you remember that would surprise people?
Well, I think the whole night is a big surprise to me. Mostly I remember my parents. My dad was still alive at the time, and I remember he and my mother being, you know, my father's an old military captain, so he is the one who would have said, "I'm not going out to that GD California, you know, that's not going, unless you're nominated, and then I will." And then it was about what he couldn't fit into his beautiful Navy. He's an officer's beautiful Navy dress mm-hmm. outfit. So I said, "Well, we'll just buy you a new one, Dad, that you can fit into, because I really would love you to be in your Navy dress outfit there." "Oh, I never thought about that," you know, because you're not used to anybody taking care of him. And my mom in her beautiful gown, and Harry Winston, and who just the jewelry store, Harry's son Ron, basically said, "You know, come into the store, pretend like it's your home, it's your shopping moment." And they had said to me, "You can have up to $500,000 worth of jewelry with no bodyguard." And I said, "Oh, please, my God, I'm not going to need a bodyguard. I'm not going to have $500,000. Oh, my gosh." And then when they heard about the gown, which is a very simple red satin gown with a shawl, they probably understood that the stylist who was working with me would suggest more bling.
Yeah.
So then they upped it to, I could have $1 million worth of jewels without a bodyguard. I was like, "Don't even worry. There's not going to be a bodyguard. We're going to be fine." And when I went, you go to the seamstress's office where they're working on your gown, mm-hmm. and all the security from Harry Winston comes over, two or three guys, and they bring up these jewelry cases, and they open them up in the back room of the seamstress's office. You're behind a curtain, and, you know, it's all so bizarre and wonderful and exciting, and try these. So you try on different things, and that's going to determine what you wear. And, of course, I chose $3 million worth of jewels. And can my mom have some too? And my sister's going to be there. Can she wear some too? And we ended up with so many millions of dollars of jewelry to wear that night that we had a bodyguard who was the cutest guy in the world. And so we were thrilled that he was there. And it was maybe those things are unusual that people don't think about what goes on.
My guest is Academy and Tony Award-winning actress Marcia Gay Harden. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yes, they are.
No, they're not.
What were we supposed to do? Sue you? No, You're blowing things out of proportion.
That is Marcia Gay Harden performing in God of Carnage, for which she won the Tony Award in 2009. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. This shouldn't surprise me, but your voice now is so mellow and calm, and it sounds nothing like what we just heard. Do you have to manage that so it lasts through the run of a play like that?
Yes, and I didn't do it so well either. I hurt my voice in the play, as you hear. The play is a story of four parents getting together, two couples, to talk about their boys who've been in a fight. And my character, our couple, is supposed to be the, okay, look, we know kids can be kids, and we've made this statement, and we don't want to make, you know, we're not going to sue you, but his teeth were bashed in, so there are the dentist bills like that, you know, that person. Any parent listening knows that as soon as another person that's not even if it's your husband, your partner, starts talking about you parenting, honey, we're talking minefield. You get defensive. Mm-hmm. And you can put on the false face. But in this particular incident, the four people come over and they're talking. And very slowly but surely, things begin to turn. And then you add alcohol and things really begin to turn. And you discover that our character, my husband and I, are in an enormous fight and an enormous, you know, held over that he's killed the hamster the night before, let the hamster free. It is ridiculous and it's enormous. And so about halfway through the play, the yelling starts. Mm-hmm. And it's not just to one level. It comes up and down and up and down, but it's intense. And she, my character, Ronnie, is very, she sees herself as a woman of civilization and let's think about, you know, the starving children in Africa kind of person. And everybody's hypocrisies come out in the play. So anyway, I hurt my voice and I had to really pull back because you have to project it at the same, you know, I'm had to be louder because I'm the first one in the play. Mm-hmm. So you have to set the standard.
Yeah.
And it's you lack nuance when you're yelling. I mean, you know, if you're singing a song and you're in the shower and you're so quiet, and oh my God, you're Billie Holiday, and you get out and you have to sing it louder, you think, where'd all those high notes go? Mm-hmm. So you have to be trained.
Does the use of microphones in pretty much every stage setting now, has that changed the way?
We didn't use mics.
You didn't use microphones at all?
No. Well, I can't stand the way they sound. Mm-hmm. It's a bright, false sound. Your question was going to be, I think, does it change the way one does?
Yeah.
Yes, it does. It changes the necessity for a kind of projection, but it doesn't sound more nuanced. Does it allow for nuance? Actually, no, because you know how it sounds kind of tinny. And to me, it makes you think you're not really in the room. You're not really on the stage.
Yeah, it's sort of coming from behind
people.
You somewhere or something.
Yeah, from behind you. And the whole idea is to be in the room with people. And in that energy and that communion, each night is different. Something happens with those particular people in an audience in a theater that is a kind of communion. And it's always different. And it's always wonderful to see where it takes you because they're the fourth wall, right? So that's the conversation coming back to you.
So there have been other productions of God of Carnage. Did you reprise the role at any point? I know you did in Angels in America. Is that right?
I never reprised it in Angels.
Okay.
I took over Angels in America from someone who had done it in California. Mm-hmm. I did a year and a half run and left the show. In God of Carnage, there were other productions of it, two others. I saw them. And now the four original cast is getting ready to go to California to do it for 2 months there, which is going to be amazing. I've never gone back to a role. And to go back and reinvestigate anger and reinvestigate all of that, it's a little bit scary, but I know it's in me, so.
I wonder if you want to avoid thinking, oh, especially with the same cast, you know these people so well, you know probably what they're thinking in certain situations. Do you want to pretend that you don't so that you can find something new? Or was it so great the first time that you're okay doing something really similar?
We don't want to repeat. Mm-hmm. Naturally, it's the same play. It's the same people. It's the same blocking. It's the same set. So there's some inherent reproduction. But deepen is the goal. Mm-hmm. Deepen, deepen, deepen. And that's what I want to do, is just deepen it and take it to some place that is more resonant. The play is very, very funny. But it doesn't work if it's not also very sad. And all of us have to be on board with that. And this group of actors is very comfortable, as I said, it was Hope Davis and Jeff Daniels and James Gandolfini, who are comfortable with giving up a laugh here to allow for something deeper that might happen over there. And that's hard, because you get that big guffaw and you think, oh, I can actually get three laughs on that one. Mm-hmm. And you have to give that up, because then you're just it becomes more like a sitcom, and then it doesn't resonate.
How different is the organism of the play based on the titters or the sighs or the gasps you're hearing from the house?
Somewhat different. Rhythm becomes different because spacing in between becomes different. You maybe don't have to hold for so long. But really, it's our we're driving it. Mm-hmm. We're not letting the audience drive it. And if you change too much based on the audience, you start losing the play. Mm-hmm. So we have someone who comes in and looks at it every couple of weeks to say, let's get back to the truth of what is this moment for you. And don't change for them. Don't try to please them. You do your play, and we're all in communion together. It sounds so esoteric in a way, doesn't it, to talk about it? But when you're doing it, you know what it is.
Well, acting is so interesting because most of us don't do it, and yet we watch a lot of it. Mm. We're probably more, not experts on it, but we see more of that than almost any other form of entertainment. And so it is interesting to sort of hear how it happens.
It's a funny thing because audiences also accept a kind of acting that, to me, I call indicating. It's someone being angry or sad, but they're playing what it looks like to be angry or sad. They're not really there. And when an actor is really there, that sends out energy, whether it's on film or stage or television. It sends out an energy that the audience receives, especially in stage, because you're not dependent on an editor or a director or the camera moving over to the other person right on the line where the energy would be. So especially on stage, when you're there, the audience feels it. And remember during Angels in America, there were, which is a play about AIDS during the Reagan era, and there were a lot of men and women who came to see it, and there would be sobbing, just like loud. You would hear from the audience at times, and men who were dying would bring their mothers and say, after they'd seen the play, "Mom, I just want you to know that, you know, I have AIDS and I'm dying," or "Dad, Mom, I'm gay," or, you know, there were groups who were righteously against the play. There were groups who were incredibly moved by the play. There were people who had to be helped out during the middle of the play because of their emotions. So that resonates on stage. We feel it, you know, and it intensifies the experience for us, but we don't change the experience.
Do you always know when you're shooting a scene on film, do you always know which take is the best, whether or not the director chooses it? Do you know which one works?
I know which one I felt was more real, and I know which one I liked, usually when I'm doing it, yes. It's sometimes not at all the one the director chooses because they maybe an airplane flew over, so they don't want to bring you back in for looping, so you don't get that take. Or they'll ask you to do something a certain way. I had a really great director on Law & Order SVU where I play this FBI character, Dana. And she is, in my view, she's a Texan. She has a Southern accent, and she's a Texan. And the thing I love about Texan women on some levels, they're not, I don't think of them as Southern belles. Mm-hmm. I think of them as ranch girls.
Yeah.
They're capable, you know, in the image, they can lasso, they can do things, they can get their hands dirty, and they can be a woman. They can just, they're women. And so that's to me who Dana was. And I based, when they offered me the role, she was investigating racism. And I thought, well, maybe she'd seen something in Texas or in the South that had hurt her as a youth. And so she chose to go into this. But she investigates everything, not just that. But that decided for me. Anyway, blah, 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 blah. I just did the second one of her. And she was raped in this episode. And she had to go on the stand. And it was written into the text that she would sob, sob, sob on the stand. And I'm saying, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, there's something about she's a soldier, you know, it's in the line of duty, and it is, she has to sob differently than a woman who, you know, works in an office or works at a grocery store would sob if she was raped and on the stand. Mm-hmm. This is a woman who's in the line of duty. So there has to be something there. And I've seen soldiers, women soldiers, when they will repeat things that happened to them, and they're factual. They're very factual. At, you know, 0800, I heard a knock on the door. At by 08, you know, 805, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So I wanted her to really be able to begin that way. And the director and the writer said, but it is still a violation. She's still a woman, and she's still violated in the deepest part of her. This rape violates her. So how can you blend that with the soldier? And I thought, well, it'll come, but it can't be sobbing. And then it just can't be that, because first of all, you'll stop listening to me. You won't feel, because I'm doing all the feeling. You have to be the one who feels something. So they were so gorgeous, the director, and often they're not. But these were like, build it, do it. So they let me do what I wanted. Then he asked me for one for him that was more the sobby one, and I did. And then they talked to me about it afterwards, and I said, please, if there's, you know, if you look at them, and for you that's both equal, please choose the one where she's not sobbing. Just choose the one where she has that resistance. I think it's more interesting. And that's what they did. And I was really grateful for that, because I'm not in control of it. Once I do it in film or television, I don't have any control.
Did it take you a while in your career to feel empowered enough to do that? I mean, now you have all these awards and people know your work, and there's a certain amount of respect that comes with that. When you were starting out, was it harder to speak up and say, I really think this works better?
Well, I wish I could be so humble and say yes, but the answer is no. I tend to speak out. And when you're trained as an actor, you are trained to know what to do.
To advocate for yourself.
To advocate for yourself. To advocate for your character, mm-hmm. actually, for your character. And although I will say I was probably a little shyer about it, certainly on Miller's Crossing, which is my first film, mm-hmm. I was right out of school. So I had presented a character, and I knew what I wanted to do with it. But there's this need, you know, in school, everyone's very supportive, and they're like, oh my God, your breathing in the scene was so good, Marcia. Really, we talk about breathing. And so here I was on this film set, and they're cut, okay, moving on, next set, and you've just done something really deep or dark or whatever, and everybody's moving the equipment someplace else, and that was a little bit scary. And the Coens knew what they wanted. They know mm-hmm. just what they want, so you don't really need to come in with a laundry list of what you want to do. But I do remember on Clint Eastwood's Space Cowboys, I had just met him the day that I started shooting, mm-hmm. and I was so nervous, I literally bit a hole through my tongue. And then I had to go out to him and say, Clint, I have to tell you, I'm so nervous, I bit a hole through my tongue, I met you, which, of course, he laughed at. And mm-hmm. then I had to do the scene, which he usually gives people one, maybe two takes, but he made me do it again and again because all the crew was laughing, because the scene would be, I think Space Shuttle Mission Control really needs us to go to the moon, or whatever it was about space. So he kept making me do it again and again, and they were laughing, and finally, but it was very friendly. They weren't mm-hmm. they weren't being mean to me. Well, in some scene, maybe day two, I said, he is setting up my blocking, and Tommy Lee is supposed to come in, and I say, Clint says, well, I want you to be here, and then Tommy will come in and you can do the scene from this desk, and we'll cover you here and cut across and cover Tommy Lee. Great. I said, well, Clint, how about if I'm sitting here and I'm typing and working on it, and when Tommy comes in, I get up and I go over there, and then I come back and I do blah, 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 blah. And he goes, how about you just do what I said? I said, okay, that's great. I'll be doing just what you said. And again, it's not mean. I mean, it sounds like it when you're telling a story, but he always says it with that glint in his eye and that smile, and he knows what he wants. And so sometimes you don't need to advocate, but I think you always want to bring ideas to the table, because they hired you. You know, you're going to try to make it better or richer. Or you can solve a problem. If somebody has a problem, gee, we're on Marcia and we want to get to John coming through the door, but if we wipe the camera to John at the door, there's a great big space in the middle. And then I think, oh, I can help that. I can be walking toward the door where my coffee cup needs to be put down. And so then it's just a quick, you know, so we can help if we know what's going on.
So do I see on your wrist you have one of those temporary kid tattoos? Is
yes.
that what that is?
Yes.
You have three school-age kids.
I do.
What is the balance like between this job that people think is so enviable and is, and then going home and having to, like, know whose science project is due and that sort of thing?
The word balance is something that I would yearn to have in my life. There's no balance. Any mother will tell you it's juggling. Do you have kids?
Yeah, I do.
How many?
Four.
Four. Wow. What's your balance like?
We're often off balance, but everybody gets where they need to go.
That's so. What I mean. You're juggling, and the balls drop all the time. Mm-hmm. And I used to think they all had to stay in the air, and I think they don't. Sometimes the kids help you pick them up. Sometimes, you know, they're parenting me sometimes, and it's a very give and take. I have twins that are six, a boy and a girl, and I have a 12-year-old daughter. And they travel with me this year because I homeschooled this year. So they're actually traveling with me. I just shot something in Rome, the Amanda Knox story. They were over there. Rome became their backyard. And
how amazing.
It was really sweet. But it's sweet in a kid way, right? Mm-hmm. So they would say, "Mom, Mom, Mom," which no one ever says my name one time. It's always three.
Yeah.
Especially my boy, "Mom, Mom, Mom." Like, yes. So they said, when we're over there, "Let's go to the Pantheon today. Let's go to the Pantheon." And you're thinking, yay, we're going to go talk about Roman history. And then they say, "Because right behind the Pantheon is that great gelato place." And I think, okay, so what? If we can get it all in, we'll get it all in. And it's tough. I mean, I do the laundry. I do the cleaning. I do the cooking. I do the homeschool. I do have a nanny who helps me, but she's not live in. And months in the summer, I don't have her. So it's probably like any other mom.
Marcia Gay Harden is my guest. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think.
Weekly trips to your therapist. What a joke! Whatever trash you pick up in the Cedar Rapids, I could care less. You don't want to stay here. You won't be able to stand it. This is morning to night. This happens over taking out the garbage!
What are you looking for? What are you pushing me for?
Stop crying about it in pain! You're dead! I can't stand it! Pain!
That was Marcia Gay Harden and Ed Harris in the film Pollock, for which she won the Academy Award. When you hear yourself in a scene like that, does any of that come rushing back for you?
Immediately. And it's almost embarrassing. I'm surprised sitting here listening or talking with you how hearing that was like yesterday or like right now. Mm-hmm. And I water at the eyes because I feel that anger that I felt then. I feel empathy for that. Also, what came to mind was, and another happy scene. And you'll wonder why people don't want to come over at Christmas.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Caroline in Fort Worth. Hi, Caroline.
Hi there. I was wondering, what is your best advice for aspiring actors? And out of all the techniques and methods you've learned through the years, what's one that's really stuck with you and helped you improve?
Am I right that I'm talking to a group of 14-year-old girls?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes.
Hi, guys. From where?
Oh, sorry. From Fort Worth Academy of Fine Arts.
Congratulations. That's wonderful. You're already on the right path, so that's great. Hi, all the girls in the room. What is one of the most important things, I think, and what I would tell to aspiring actors, and unfortunately it sounds so parental, but it is greater than that, is education. Someone once said to me, there's nothing more boring than a dumb actress. And I think there's nothing more boring than a dumb actress or a dumb girl that just doesn't want to learn about the world and have ideas about the world and have opinions about the world and have a gratitude for the world in which we live. And so education is that path. Many different venues for it, many different, whether it's school or, living, I don't believe in just sort of living the experience and then going and doing a great job. I think real education is really important. And then for an actress, I think training. A lot of actresses who do theater, who only come from the film world, really can't make the connection with the audience that they need to because they don't have training. They don't have vocal training. They don't have the ability to let their bodies fill the space. And it's literally, if you think about it, you're sending the energy of your body and your voice into, you're going into the audience's body. So you have to be able to focus that energy through training to go inside their body so they feel something. And if you can't make it past the, stage lip, then they'll have a fun experience, but they won't go away moved or transformed in any way.
It has been demonstrated over and over that men can play like the sexy leading man roles well into their 60s. Mm. And for women, it's like when you turn 40 somehow, everything dries up. And obviously you're working and doing great things still. But do you think the problem is that there are so few female directors? Or where does that...
Boy, that's a question that's going to could go on. I think that if life is survival of the fittest on some level, that a woman's ability to reproduce stops at a certain age. And it is just ingrained in our anthropological memory that therefore she is no longer sexual. And the man can continue to produce well into his, like you said, 60s. You're talking about we know produce children. And so therefore, in the mind, there's an acceptance of an older man being this way. What I think is a battle cry for women is to insist on the ability and the beauty of aging and their full being. And I know that now I'm talking to 14-year-old girls, so I feel like girls just,
enjoy it while you got it.
Us old dames are not. But really what I mean to say is that we need role models. We need role models in women and who are beautiful. And I'll say sexual in terms of owning your own being. And we need to insist that we can age. And it's very, very difficult because you have media and magazines and films telling us that the only great way to be in film or television is to be very young or with lots of plastic surgery. Mm-hmm. So the more of us who insist on something different, certainly the more women directors, certainly the more women writers, and certainly women supporting women, women going to see women's films. And I don't mean like chick flicks, just women supporting women, because it's commercial, right? If a film doesn't sell, no one's going to want to make them. And boy, action movies sell. Hmm. So you have those real, real issues, and I can't blame anyone on anybody. I mean, look, in ancient Rome, they weren't making statues of the, old, wizened, the fat lady, whatever. They were making statues of beautiful young Roman girls because in art, that's what people consider beautiful. So that's great. But as you girls, you 14-year-old girls are out trying to bring your gifts as actresses to the world, certainly there's a beauty and a youth and sexuality and all those things that you have, but your wisdom and your intelligence and your education are the things that raise the level of the universe and the world. Those are the things, and those are the things you need to bring. And you know what? On some subterranean level, I do believe that that will make a universal difference. Wars, all of these, the violence against women, all these things. Your age, you have the power. You girls have it right in your hand to make a difference by honoring yourselves and honoring your wisdom. So like your mothers, I'm sure.
It's funny, though, they might not listen to their moms with the same exact advice, but somehow coming from someone else.
It's true. Youth is so powerful, so, so powerful. And to use it and focus it toward change and love and gratitude, those are really powerful tools.
Would you go back if you could, though? Would you want to be 25 again?
No, I love being 51. I love the way I look at 51. I love the way I am at 51. I've been through several tests of late, and I'm really glad with who I am. If I went back, I would probably do things differently. I wouldn't be so in the moment. I wouldn't be so needy for boy attention. I would do more of what I'm saying to these girls if I could go back. But I did always focus on education as well, so I would probably just try to be a little bit cleaner. I'd clean up my act.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. Speaking with Bobby in Fort Worth. Hi, Bobby.
Hi. I just wanted to tell Marcia Gay that about 25 years ago, I had the joy of working with her father, Captain Hardin, and I know where she got her values and what made her such a great person. He was a super person to work with, and I really I think about him every time I see one of Marcia Gay's movies.
Where did you work with him, Bobby?
At the Federal Aviation Administration. I was an engineer there.
That was here in Texas, though, right?
Yes, it was here in Fort Worth.
Oh, well, that's lovely. He was a great naval officer, and he loved his country, and he served it so beautifully, and then went into working with the Federal Aviation with you and a bunch of other people, and he was just always so proud of the... I think he would say to me one day, you know that TV set you're watching? Well, the Navy put those satellites up in the air. Everything was the Navy. So thank you so much for being so gracious to call.
How did your parents feel about you choosing a career in the arts? Are you the only one of your siblings who did that?
I have a brother who's a photographer. My sister works here at the Dallas VA. Her name is Leslie Jernigan, and she was an interior designer, is an interior mm-hmm. designer there, and works in engineering now. So there's an artistic... She was a painter, but then she went to work there. My other sister's a forensic toxicologist, and my youngest sister is a fantastic and fabulous mom. So... my brother and I suppose, went into it. Initially, my dad used to say, you need to get some training in computers because if this doesn't work out, you know, how are you going to make a living? And I didn't want to. I wish I had now because I'm a computer geek. I'm an idiot. I'm not a geek. I wish I was a geek. But I didn't want to at the time because I felt like I don't want to give myself an out. I don't want to give myself an open door. So I waited a lot of tables and worked at Four Seasons and the Pierre Hotel and... you know, that was what I did for a long, long, long time. They initially were supportive of me following my dream, but really nervous. And I remember when my dad, if Bobby's still listening, he'll recognize this. When my dad and mom first came to New York, my mother's a very gentle, beautiful Dallas lady, very lovely. And my dad's, you know, kind of gruff and proud. He came up to New York and I was living in the West Village, and he would walk around the West Village kind of as I was moving my things in with his hand clamped to his right buttocks.
And like he was going to be mugged or something?
That's it. I said, Dad, what are you doing? That's my wallet back there, and I'm not going to have anyone steal it. And I said, Dad, you're in the West Village. You might want to take your hand off your behind, okay? And he would laugh, you know, and laugh at it. But he really got behind me. I suspect this was about 25 years ago when I got my first movie, mm-hmm. when I would get my first reviews and plays. The reviews and plays made him think, you know, because I'm his daughter, right? So he thinks, of course, he's proud of me, but
yeah.
Maybe it's just a lie. But once he would see critics reviewing me, well, maybe there is. Maybe there is this thing in her. And once I got Miller's Crossing, that was an interesting experience for us because I played a girl of looser values, a gun mall. And when my dad and mom came to see it, Fox had set up a beautiful screening for us out in L.A., and they flew out there, and we had a private screening with all my friends. And when the movie was over, I was driving dad and mom to a restaurant where we were going to meet my friends, and he wouldn't talk to me. And there was this silence in the car. And I said, well, you know, upset that I had to bring it up. It should have been mm-hmm. effusive. They should have been pouring whatever they thought out. Mom was doing it. I finally said, well, Dad, you know, mincing lips now, what'd you think? Because I didn't want to have to ask. And he said, well, I thought the direction was superlative. I thought the screen design was superlative. The sets were superlative. And he went on down the list. I mean, mm-hmm. finally, like the, you know, the boom operator was superlative. Pause.
What about me?
Pause. Yeah. Exactly. I said, what about me, Dad? What'd you think of me? And he said, well, I wouldn't want to know her. Right? So yeah. He couldn't make this connection. And of course, it crushed me. Uh-huh. So I punished him by not getting up the next morning to get him a cup of coffee and see him off to the airport. That was my big punishment. But of course, I ran out in the hall to say goodbye. Well, 2 weeks later, he sent me the most beautiful letter where he basically said, I didn't know how to marry you too. That was so you mm-hmm. up there and so her that it made me think that she was you.
What a compliment.
And that she didn't, that you don't have these values and you played a tramp and is that you? And he just couldn't do it, but it took him 2 weeks to process it. And then I have this gift of this letter, mm-hmm. which is so beautiful and humble. And, you know, my dad was really not a very humble person. So, but deeply, he was. Mm-hmm. So I think ultimately they supported. My mother has always supported me. My mother's, in fact, responsible for the first play I ever got. It was I Ought to Be in Pictures, and it was at the little, sort of like the YMCA theater kind of thing, the little theater in Old Town Alexandria in Virginia. And she said, oh, looky here. I see something in the paper about a... They need a character. She sounds just like you, Marcia Gay. I said, no, Mom, I Ought to Be in Pictures as a musical. I'm not going to go audition for that. I can't sing. I don't think it is. It doesn't say musical. Mom, it's a musical. So we argue. Finally, she goes, well, I'll drive you down there and we'll see. So I go in. It's not a musical. I audition for it. Come back for callbacks, third callbacks, and I get the role. And I get great reviews, which really on some level was my little launch.
Yeah.
Little teeny thing. Suddenly other reviewers in D.C. and theaters are saying, who's this girl who got those reviews? So that was my mother. My mother has always, always, always been there for me in every way. She's climbed up 7 flights to help me move in New York City when I'm in a 7th floor walk-up, hauling boxes, and she's just been there.
Marcia, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.